If you're in a room with eight women, one of them is likely to develop invasive breast cancer in her lifetime. And for more than 15% of the women who do that, it's going to be fatal. If Dr. Mary Claire King had never gone into cancer research, that number might be higher. And the University of Washington doctor almost didn't. Dr. King told the story to Marcy Silman. It started back in 1960s with chimpanzees.
Using the technologies that were available at the time, which of course are by today's standards very basic, we were able to show that what we would now call the coding sequences of genes, and at that time we called the genes, of chimpanzees are 99% the same as those of humans.
Which is a whole interview in and of itself.
Indeed.
I'm talking to Mary Claire King, and one might think after a dissertation like this that her career was phenomenal in some sort of genetic anthropology, but no, you would be wrong. That was just one of the things she's done. The leap from that to studying breast cancer seems like a chasm. How did you make that transition?
It happened by chance. Immediately on finishing my degree, I was married at the time, and my husband and I went to Santiago, Chile. This was in 72, and we were there before and during the coup. But we couldn't stay that long. It was clear that we needed to leave, that we were a danger to our friends and ourselves. So I arrived back in Berkeley with, of course, no job. And it was, by coincidence, also the beginning of Nixon's war on cancer. So there were a large number of new positions available in good medical centers like UCSF, and I applied for and was offered one of them.
Tell me about that lab at UCSF. What was it like?
Right. Well, it was particularly welcoming. I mean, it was very fortunate because the person who ran the lab, Dr. Nick Petrakis, he very much wanted to see research happen that would allow prevention and cure. And he really just gave me my head. He said, follow your ideas. And my thinking was that in the same way that we can identify at the genetic level differences between humans and chimpanzees, that's one fact. Then the second fact is that the work on breast cancer that had been done since the early part of the 20th century had demonstrated that it clustered in families. So I thought, okay, if we have, you know, in the Sherlock Holmes perspective, if we have eliminated all other possibilities, the only thing left might be genetics. And if I can show differences between species, I should be able to show differences within families that separate people who develop this disease from people who do not.
I know that you proved the idea of the passing on the genes before you actually found the gene itself.
That's absolutely true. So a little math goes a long way, and I knew how to do equations. So the hypothesis was, if we inquire of a very large number of women who have breast cancer, what's your family history of breast cancer? And we get very good data on that. Do the patterns that we see correspond to what we would expect if breast cancer were common but were scattered at random in families, or if it were clustered in families, and if it clustered in families for reasons that fit best to what we would expect if there was a gene, or as it turned out, genes, with mutations that had individually very severe effects. So that was all math.
How many other people picked up on your idea after you published the statistical paper?
Oh, the statistical paper alone?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, not many.
Not many.
But after we published the locale, then it was like a cascade effect. It was opening a dam, and the race was on to clone this gene.
How important was it for you to do it first?
It felt like an athletic event. During the race, I thought it would matter enormously to us to be the ones that cloned it. I mean, I'm very competitive, and I thought we have got to be the ones. When we weren't, I was amazed that it was okay. The idea that it was solved and that we'd be able to move on to the next step and actually exploit it for prevention and treatment, it was a huge relief.
Once somebody else went ahead and made that initial discovery, do you, who devoted all these years, decades of your life to this, do you just say, oh, well, I'm going to move on to something else? Or what happens?
Oh, no, no. The day the gene was cloned, we did exactly the same thing the next morning that we would have done if we cloned the gene. Mm-hmm. It makes absolutely no difference who clones the gene. What matters is that you know what the gene is and you have the materials at hand to be able to take the next step.
I'm talking to Dr. Mary Claire King, and she's the American Cancer Society professor at the University of Washington. Last fall, you won the Lasker Prize, and you raised some eyebrows, not because you won the prize, mm-hmm. but you at the time advised that women right. age 30 until mm-hmm. they're done with their childbearing years mm-hmm. be screened for the presence of these genes. Why was that recommendation controversial?
Okay, so the recommendation that I make is that every woman be offered at about age 30 full sequencing for BRCA1 and BRCA2. The reason it's important is that mutations in these genes are absolutely devastating, and they are inherited from fathers as often as from mothers. And therefore, half of women who have mutations in these genes have no reason to believe they have mutations in these genes because they have no family history of breast or ovarian cancer. So it's important for women to know if they carry such mutations so they can make a plan.
Angelina Jolie is probably the most famous face of somebody who had a prophylactic hysterectomy and a double mastectomy. At some point, do you envision a time when there would be some, I guess, less drastic intervention for somebody with a mutation on these genes?
Right. That's a great question. It's a great question. There is already genotype-driven therapy. So the question then arises, could something like that be used rather than a surgical approach? The answer is, in principle, yes. The understanding in the field, and this is a little bit outside of what I know, so I'm reporting mm-hmm. the work of others to you, is that the side effects that go along with those treatments are far more devastating. It would be lovely if there were a benign medical approach. It would be fabulous. But right now, the medical approaches are less benign than the surgical ones.
But you can't say that it might not exist in 20 years.
Quite so. Who would have known 20 years ago what we'd be here now?
We have just touched on a couple of aspects of your amazing career. Of all these varied and important subjects, what are you most proud of?
I'm most proud of being able to think like a geneticist. I'm most proud of genetics as a way of thinking and of being able to exploit the technology that's now available in order to test the ideas that we think of, to really enjoy genetics as a way of thinking and exploit genomics as a set of tools. That's what I'm most proud of.
Dr. Mary Claire King, American Cancer Society professor at the University of Washington, speaking with Marcy Silman. Mary Claire King discovered the so-called breast cancer gene, transforming the way we treat cancer today, and she's one of the subjects of a new PBS documentary series, Cancer, the Emperor of All Maladies. Seattle Town Hall is hosting a preview screening of that documentary tonight at 7 o'clock. And if you'd like to hear more from Dr. Mary Claire King, she told a story on the Moth Radio Hour called Who Can You Trust? And you can find that at moth.org.